Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In Ethiopia, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres repeated on Wednesday his call for the immediate release of United Nations staff members detained there. In a statement issued by his spokesperson, the UN chief said that the staff members were being held without charge and that no specific information had been provided about why they were arrested. UN staff carry out critical and impartial work in Ethiopia, Mr. Guterres added, before expressing concern over reports of arbitrary arrests and detentions. These only serve to widen divisions and resentment between groups, he warned, as he reiterated his call for a ceasefire and for all parties to prioritize the welfare of civilians. To Bosnia and Herzegovina now, where a survey by the UN Population Fund, UNFPA, has shown that nearly one in two young adults are thinking of leaving the country. A lack of opportunities and political instability was cited by 47% of 18 to 29-year-olds as among the main reasons for wanting to emigrate from the Balkan state. 24% said they wanted to leave permanently. Many also said that they wanted to live in a less corrupt society, according to the UN Fund, which called for increased public participation in policymaking to promote trust in the government. Since 2011, 200,000 people have left the country, said UNFPA, adding that this would continue unless there is a drastic change in tackling persistent challenges since the Bosnian War ended in the mid-1990s. These problems include high unemployment, weak social protection, poor data and aging population, low fertility rates and significant gender inequality. COVID-19 cases increased last week with 3.3 million new infections reported globally, according to the World Health Organization, WHO. In its weekly epidemiological update, the UN Health Agency noted that this marked a 6% increase in infections since the previous week, with the highest number of new cases in the United States. Regionally, the Americas, the European and the Western Pacific regions all reported increases in new weekly cases compared to the previous 7 days. In contrast, all other regions reported stable or declining trends. In Europe, there were more than 2.1 million new cases and at least 28,000 deaths in the last week, which is a 5% rise, making it the only region not to report a stable or declining number of coronavirus fatalities. More than a third of European countries saw COVID deaths rise by more than 10% in the last week, while the greatest change was in Norway, which registered a 67% increase, followed by Slovakia and Croatia. Latest data from the WHO indicates that there have been more than 250 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 and at least 5 million deaths. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Dr. William Bronson, the author of the just-published book, Public Hostage, Public Ransom. This is a great book. It exposes the story of Willowbrook, a hellhole on Staten Island that was exposed 50 years ago. Conditions in this asylum, this warehouse, obtains today throughout the United States thanks to Medicaid. Give a listen. We speak with the leading anti-drone activist in the United States, Nick Moturn, from Ban Killer Drones. These killer drones recently killed a family of 10 people in Afghanistan, but they've been operating by Bush, Trump, now Biden, killing people really illegally, indiscriminately across the globe. Give a listen to this.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
In the 1970s, the shocking horrors of Willowbrook State School on Staten Island in New York City were exposed to the entire world. Some 200,000 disabled people live in isolated large public warehouses in every state, segregated from the rest of society and horribly abused and neglected daily. Some 30,000 were living at Willowbrook at the time. Dr. William Bronston worked at the largest one, holding 6,000 incarcerated children and adults. He worked there over a three-year period on the inside. He helped organize the parent community to file a federal class action lawsuit, literally for crimes against humanity, telling the truth about this horrific place, the Willowbrook hellhole. Attorney Richard Levy and I speak with him today. Mistreatment of people with disabilities and elderly persons is facilitated because the mostly private institutions that hold them hostage in every community get massive Medicaid funding. It is a national scandal and a threatening harbinger for all of us. The ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle said, quote, "Life in the community is a necessary condition for a person's complete flourishing as a human being." This is what needs to be done, reintegrating these people into the community. It's the goal today across the USA. Dr. William Branson has just come out with a significant book entitled Public Hostage, Public Ransom, Ending Institutional America. We speak today with Dr. Branson. We're also joined in this interview by my friend and colleague, attorney Richard Levy. It was Richard's law firm, Eisner & Levy, who represented Dr. Branson in a class action against the state of New York. Dr. William Branson, welcome to Law and Disorder. Do you mind if I call you Bill?
Absolutely, Michael. Thank you so much.
Bill, please tell us something about your background. What made you so political? What kind of education did you get? And what was the political situation like in the country when you were coming up? And what helped shape you at school?
Well, Michael, I grew up in the 60s during the height of the civil rights movement and the struggle against the war in Vietnam, which was, ubiquitous. And I was in medical school, and I was very frustrated at the lack of humanity in the curriculum and became very actively involved in organizing all the medical students in my medical school, the University of Southern California, setting up an independent student newspaper and putting together a large forum, a national forum, inviting the best and most significant people in social medicine in the country to come and speak to us. And it just became part of my sense of why I became a doctor. I mean, I was absolutely devoted to service. I love people, and I love the community of friends that had a purpose in their life.
Bill, this is Richard. You wrote a terrific book about the situation at Willowbrook, which, of course, is horrifying, or was at the time. Could you say something about how you wound up at Willowbrook, and also, if it's possible in a short time, to say something that would describe some of the conditions at Willowbrook, of course, physical conditions, medical treatment conditions, and developmental conditions that existed in the institution at the time?
Well, I moved to New York from Kansas, where I was doing a psychiatric residency, and I had been essentially fired from that residency and expelled because I'd organized an American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employee Union in order to have true representation and to change the plantation system of their mental health hospital situation. So when I came to New York, I really was kind of off balance, and I needed to find a place where they wouldn't check my references. And I lived in Staten Island at that particular time, and Willowbrook was there, and my training all through medical school had been with a child development leader in the country. His name was Dr. Richard Koch, and he trained me in understanding child development and the whole world of working with families that had kids that were suspected of having slow development. And so Willowbrook was a natural place for me to go because I knew I would be familiar with the caseload, with the clientele of the place, and I had no idea really what I was walking into.
Bill, what was your strategy in trying to change Willowbrook?
Well, my first concern was that I walked into a situation that was completely, completely foreign to me. There was no transfer notes. I didn't get any kind of off-service orientation from the prior physicians that were responsible for the people that I was there for. And when I arrived, I was assigned a building with 200 of the most broken children you can imagine, with only one nurse per shift, two workers per 50 people. And I was just aghast. I mean, the charts were 6 inches thick, filled with incident notices rather than any clinical analysis. And what struck me was that there didn't seem to be any plan to move these young people back into society. Let me read you, if I could, a one-page that is the introduction to one of the photo chapters in my book, if I may, which would give you some feeling.
Sure.
So the chapter is called Living Death Alone, and it starts off this way. It says, all that is necessary to kill life is to deny growth, to deny a future, to relegate life to a perpetual, monotonous, suffocating, and repetitive present. Life energy, the struggle to grow and change, is the most powerful human force we know. To stifle that force takes incredible and constant repression. Global denial of life exists in the institutions. It's so all-pervasive and essentially uniform that to the casual observer, it may be altogether unapparent. People who come from the outside to see the institution would walk about and invariably be unable to bring themselves to see the evidence before their eyes. Why the looks of lifelessness, hopelessness, despair, emptiness? It must be mental retardation. That's why these people are here in the first place. Not true. How filthy, what an odor. How deafening the echoing noise, the things of the institution, the lesser crimes, the objects that we respond to, dodge the central reality. What the visitor cannot log is the state of the hostages, the death of the spirit, each in his own or her own decline. This is not mental retardation. This is not emotional disorder. This is not developmental disability. This is not illness, God's will, or any other trumped-up ideology. This is a phase of monetized extermination, public extermination of the unwanted, the devalued, the powerless, the institutionalized of our country. There, to a greater or lesser extent, children and adults are marked for death by the systematic denial of their lives and their innate capacity to grow and change. Some go quicker than others. Most live on, mimicking life for decades. Here, the most outrageous of all crimes of the institution, the crime against humanity. Look carefully, slowly, at the living death, the consequence of massive and systematic repression, the toll to our society, to fellow citizens, rendered to this state of existence has yet to be fully documented and even minimally responded to by the public. It will continue as long as any people are seen and treated as less than you and I. So that is the introduction to a 20-photograph section in the book. There are four photographic sections. There's 80 pictures in the book to try and teach people how to see violence, not to see grotesqueness or spectacle, but to understand that this was a man-made crime against humanity that continues all over the country today.
Bill, can you give us some description of how that struggle that you were a leader in, how that unfolded with parents, within the institution, with workers, and what the goal was of the confrontation and the fight that you and the parents and the workers undertook?
You know, in the state of New York, there was no community-based services of any kind. There was only 30 of these gigantic institutions ranging in size from 200 beds to Willowbrook, which has 6,000-plus people in it. It took me a long time, to understand the scope of what was going on. But one thing that was really dramatic was that the families who came to see their kids and to try and maintain some touch with their child were never allowed in the buildings. The workers would bring the individual to the front door and really propel them out the front door to the families and never let the families see inside, which was really dramatic to me. And so the first thing I began doing was making sure that anybody who came to visit could see concretely how awful the situation was, the smell and the sounds and the filth of the place and the status of the other people in the institution. The workers didn't want that to happen, and the administration was very, very set to avoid allowing anybody to see how really dehumanizing the situation was. And so that was the first step, to get the parents out of the paralysis that they were experiencing and the guilt that they were experiencing, in order to understand that they had rights, that they were paying taxes, that there was something that had to be done here. I mean, the carloads of tranquilizing drugs that were put in to people as a result of the lack of adequate staffing in order to essentially immobilize them so that one or two people could manage a ward of 50 completely bored, completely frustrated, you know, folks that were so deprived of any touch, any warmth, any comfort. you know, that they did anything they could in order to get attention, you know, which in every instance led to terrible injuries. And that was the status everywhere in the institution.
What was the outcome of the struggle, Bill?
Well, the families slowly but surely understood that something was desperately wrong and that what they were seeing was not the problem of their kid, it was the problem of the barbarous conditions that the people were kept in, and the arrogance and the alienation of the administration, who never went to the wards, never saw what was really going on below them. And so we began to put together a major campaign, and my colleague who was fired, Mike Wilkins, invited a lawyer friend of ours, Geraldo Rivera, who had just gotten a job at ABC Television, to come in and to look at the situation. And Geraldo brought a camera, and there was this spectacular expose that opened up on ABC Television. And that was so dramatic and so profound that the whole state was essentially electrified by his reporting, which continued three or four or five times afterwards. He kept coming back. And so at that point, there was this tremendous effort to think about fixing Willowbrook. And I knew that you could never, never, ever fix this horrendous place, that you could pour tens of millions of dollars into it and you would still have this horrendous, horrible, violent milieu. So we organized a meeting of all the top leadership parents around the state, of all the top lawyers that have been filing class action lawsuits in the Eastern Seaboard against human abuse in institutions, and the major academic leaders that were teaching developmental services in the colleges to a gathering, and charged them with establishing a class action lawsuit that would correct the failures of the prior class action lawsuits that would expedite the change at Willowbrook. And out of that came the Willowbrook class action lawsuit. And from that, we were able then to begin to mobilize a radical change away from fixing this place to closing it, which was essential. And of course, when the suit finally was seated in the federal court, there was a gathering of the most vaunted professionals in the United States and families testifying about the conditions and the situation. The judge came to Willowbrook to look at it and to walk through it, which I think must have been tremendously traumatic for him. And the result was that a verdict was rendered to essentially close the place, and which was a step nationally in terms of other suits that we had begun to mobilize in 37 other states against institutions, warehouses for people with special needs. This did not involve people with mental health diagnoses. These were just people with developmental disabilities, mental retardation, autism, cerebral palsy, spina bifida, learning disabilities, and so forth, that had been shoveled into these warehouses because the public service system completely rejected serving them. The school system refused to take a kid with special needs at that time into classes because of a label. And families were just overwhelmed in terms of the cost and the time. Most of them were poor working class families. And the result was that people were essentially jammed to put their kid into an institution. The whole medical profession was so biased against mental retardation, they saw it as a chronic, hopeless disease in the medical model, rather than a developmental situation that could radically be changed by high-quality educational input. So, of course, what happened was that we won the suit after about two or three years. It took a long time, and it took 20, 25 years for the place to be finally decentralized. What happened was that the state was required, under federal monitoring, to establish single living arrangements, places that were no larger than six beds, in order to relocate everybody that was in Willowbrook. The problem, of course, was that there was no follow-up suit that would have created a comparable correction in the other three score organizations, institutions that existed in New York at the time. And so only the Willowbrook caseload was properly relocated. Now, you know, Eric Adams, who just won the mayoral race, said publicly in an interview that Willowbrook should never have been closed and that it was the cause of the tremendous amount of homelessness on the streets of New York, which is utterly, utterly not the case. Nobody that was in the Willowbrook class wound up on the street because they were federally monitored individually, you know, by the federal court in order to make sure that they were properly provided domiciliary services.
Can you talk a little bit about where we are today in terms of the closing of these massive institutions that warehouse people with challenges, in terms of what has taken its place and what still has to be done? Can you talk about sort of the broader picture?
You understand that all of this has to do with money and power. Money and power. What happens is that the federal government in 1965 passed Title 19 of the Social Security Act and created Medicaid. Medicaid is the culprit in all of this, because Medicaid, for example, in 2020, Medicaid paid $8.3 billion in order to provide services in out-of-home placement to people in New York that were either elderly poor or people with disabilities or blind. And it's that river of money, enormous river of money, that essentially has created this gigantic industry of out-of-home residential little warehouses, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, hospice programs, most of which are owned and operated by private and not nonprofit, for-profit organizations in chains. And so what's happened is that instead of having these large, easily targeted, gigantic hell holes, these American concentration camps, we have a whole culture of smaller, awful places where the workers are paid, you know, meaningless wages, untrained, mostly people of color, mostly women, and they're just one step above in status and in capacity the folks that they're taking care of. And we've become accustomed in the last 50 or 60 years to unload our dependent family members into this institutional culture, which is entirely funded by Medicaid. This would never have happened without Medicaid's money. And we have to end Medicaid. We have to make sure that we have a universal, single-payer healthcare system that essentially converts long-term care to what I call lifetime care, individualized planning for every individual to deflect them from congregate, segregated terminus in their lives.
Bill, there's another kind of question I wanted to ask you. Reading your book, it's quite an impact on the reader concerning the people who were working at an institution like Willowbrook. And I'm referring to doctors, healthcare workers, other support staff, and management, all of whom seemed somehow able to look the other way, not be affected the way the reader of the book is probably going to be, looking at those pictures of desperate children and horrible conditions and filth. How did people work there, and how did they not respond, you know, from the directors down to the working people? How did they get through the days?
Well, you know, you're dealing with a cultural pillar that essentially communicates through all the media, the places and the labels and the associations, a sense of less than human folk that are essentially being serviced. There was a very beautiful a book review in last Sunday's book review that was titled Kaddish, about a woman who wrote about the way in which the extermination camps, the Holocaust survivors, were, and the whole Holocaust process was totally sanitized and in the language that we used. And the title of the book, I think, is Everybody Loves a Dead Jew. And I think the same thing exists here in dealing with people with developmental disabilities. They are, by definition, less than human and essentially marginalized and disappeared in society. And then people get hired to work in these places, and with the cover of a medical model, with doctors essentially writing prescriptions and essentially validating the way in which people are served, they fall in line. They don't know any better, and they don't have power to deal with it. And the wages in the public sector, you know, with public benefits, healthcare services, and so forth, are very precious to hold on to for people that are at the margin of the economy, poor people, that essentially are the folks that are working in these places. People would travel sometimes an hour and a half or 2 hours from Jersey and from other parts of the city in order to get to Willowbrook to work because it was in a very remote place, which is always the case where you're dealing with devalued people. So you're in a situation where everything around you says, this is okay. The people around you say, this is okay. And corruption begins to build in. Cynicism begins to build in. And there has to be a truth-telling description. That's why I have so heavily illustrated the book, because I want people to see something different than they would normally see, to understand something much more dramatic, much more intimate about what it means to ravage a human being, what it means to have a system that ravages life, and that co-opts decent, caring, loving family people to be complicit. Now, the doctors are a whole other, another story. The doctors that worked at Willowbrook couldn't get a job anywhere else. They were either foreign-born, or they didn't have good licenses, or they didn't speak good English, or they just were corrupted by the system and part of the elite circle that included the administration. And the administration, of course, drove around in big black Cadillacs and got, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of salary. And the whole thing was governed by a medical model, by a psychiatrist who was the commissioner of the mental health department that was the administrative mechanism that oversaw the Willowbrooks of the state of New York. And there were 30 of them like that, big ones like that. So you have a situation that's very, very corrupting and very intoxicating because it's universal. There's no alternative, and there's nobody telling the truth that can survive the reactionary onslaught of repression that comes if you challenge these abuses in society. It's the same thing, for example, with the school system. The school system may not be very good in the state of New York, but who's going to take on the whole school system? You've got to go against the teachers' union. You've got to go against the governor. You've got to go against a gigantic status quo, you know, and cultural paradigm that's very hard for people who see the truth at the beginning to be able to prevail in challenging the need for humanizing, individualizing, elevating the dignity and the integrity and the empowerment of the individual. And then you've got racism sitting on top of everything else. You know, so many of the people at Willowbrook were people of color. Most of the workers were people of color. And so you have a structural demonstration of how racism works in society at a mega level. And the book essentially tries to deal with that. I try and get as close to the intimate truth and reality of the horror of the crimes against humanity that are the norm and that are accepted. Everything's okay. People go to work every day, or they don't. And whatever happens, you know, life goes on. And the parent community, which is really the source of truth, the source of morality, is kept at arm's length and crippled individually by being seen as a part of the problem. You know, and unless they talk to each other, unless the families talk to each other, unless lawyers and progressive academics that are teaching child development interact with the families, you don't have a block, a political block of change and a different kind of a voice to address the crimes, the immorality, the horror of the way in which people are so heavily funded to maintain.
We've been speaking with Dr. William Bronston, who's just published book, Public Hostage, Public Ransom, Ending Institutional America, has just come out. I want to credit my friend and colleague, Richard Levy, a New York State attorney whose law firm, Eisner & Levy, were the attorneys for Bill Bronston, who brought the class action lawsuit. Bill, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time, but before we have to say goodbye to you, Richard and I want to ask you, how can people get the book, and how can they stay in touch with what you've been trying to do?
Well, I put up a website, Mike. The website is called publichostagepublicransom.org. And in that website, there's a lot of very powerful material, and they can go to that. The book is available online. They can purchase the book at Target, at Amazon.com, at BarnesandNoble.com, on Google, on eBay. The softback is like $28, and the hardback is $40, and there's an ebook. But I would urge people, if they're interested, to get the hard copy, because you have to look at the pictures face to face, and I don't think that the ebook has that capability of looking at more than one page at a time. I'm not sure. I don't like looking at digital reading. I need the book in my hand, the smell and the weight and the quality. The book is a very beautiful product. So my email is William Bronston, MD. William Bronston, one word, MD, at gmail.com. And I would welcome any kind of question or concern and urge people that, I mean, this struggle is extant. It's happening right now. We must end the medical wealth transfer system as we know it today. And that's part of what's going on with the big piece of legislation to modify the Affordable Care Act, which really we have to outlaw the private insurance industry outright. As long as the private insurance industry continues to participate in the services, the medical services to people, we will have death, destruction, and inhumanity. We've got to get the money out of the delivery system as a benefit, and we can't have people pay anything out of pocket in order to get comprehensive, guaranteed, single quality care in America. That's the
Thanks,
challenge.
Bill.
Thanks, Bill. Again, the book is Public Hostage, Public Ransom by William Bronston, MD. And Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill. Every success in what you've been doing, we greatly admire you. You take it easy.
Thank you very much, sir. Very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Biden pulled U.S. forces out of Afghanistan. His administration launched a Hellfire missile from an MQ-9 Reaper drone in Kabul that killed 10 civilians, including 7 children, and then lied about it. They called it a righteous strike conducted in self-defense. Nearly 3 weeks later, an extensive investigation by the New York Times revealed that the target of the drone strike, Zamari Ahmadi, was a U.S. aid worker, not an ISIS operative, and the so-called explosives in the Toyota that the drone targeted were most likely water bottles. Now, a quote, independent, unquote, Pentagon review has concluded that no crimes were committed by U.S. forces, even though footage showed a child present minutes before the drone attack. The Air Force Inspector General admitted that 9 seconds before the strike, the surveillance video showed the presence of 4 children in the strike zone. But under international law, a targeted killing is only legal if it's necessary to protect life and no other means, including capture or non-lethal incapacitation, is available to protect life. Modern is co-coordinator of bankillerdrones.org. He said, quote, "The Pentagon's assertion that no one did anything illegal to cause the drone deaths of the Ahmadi family members is a shameful sidestepping and a further cover-up of who made what decisions and why in this horrible slaughter. We need to see all the records surrounding this incident, including those that may help us to know the role of President Biden, if any," unquote. BanKillerDrones.org is calling for reparation payments of at least $3 million for each of the 10 members of the Ahmadi family. Meanwhile, although Biden withdrew the troops from Afghanistan, he has pledged to continue over-the-horizon operations from afar. Biden is following in the footsteps of his predecessors, who all used drone strikes that killed untold numbers of civilians. The drone that killed the Ahmadi family was operating out of Creech Air Base in Nevada. BanKiller Drones helped organize the annual Shutdown Creech Week from September 26th through October 2nd. We are fortunate today to be speaking with BanKiller Drones' Nick Modern. Nick has been a tireless organizer of the movement to ban armed drones. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Nick.
Yes, thank you, Marjorie. I'm very honored to be here.
Nick, the U.S. government learned from the Vietnam War that Americans oppose U.S. wars when they see soldiers return in body bags. Drones, which are controlled thousands of miles away, don't result in pilot deaths, but most drone pilots get PTSD. How do families and communities of drone victims feel about the United States? What are double taps? Do drones make us any safer?
Well, I think that your questions are very appropriate in terms of the impact that these drone attacks have had when you ask about how do the families and communities of drone victims feel. And there's quite a bit of commentary and evidence interviews that show that, number one, these drone attacks are far from precise, that the harm to civilians, the people not targeted, is widespread, it's indiscriminate, it's essentially illegal under international law. Because it is widespread, because it can't be controlled once a drone attacks, the fear that's generated among those in the family, the communities, is something that can cause people to refuse to go out of the house for a certain amount of time, not go to jobs for a long period of time, and also, especially children, to be extremely fearful of just looking at the sky. And of course, when the buzzing of drones continues after one of these attacks, it's even worse. So the testimony is that each drone attack generates many more people who then want to attack the United States. And if we look at Afghanistan, and there's this question that's arisen, wow, why did the Afghan soldiers just throw down their weapons, and how did the Taliban come to take over this country so quickly? I think if you realize that Afghanistan was the most drone-attacked country in the world, there has been an estimate of up to 10,000 Afghan people being killed by drones. It's a very conservative estimate because all the facts aren't in. about the extent of the killing, each one of those people had families and they were living in community. And so the drone attacks were very memorable and very consequential in prolonging the war, I think, but also in creating an environment where once the United States, you know, made it clear that it was not going to be attacking anymore, then the Afghan government, even the soldiers in the Afghan government, were probably related to many people killed by these drones. So the use of drone warfare in Afghanistan, I think, a root not only in prolonging the war, but the way it ended.
Nick, you've criticized the U.S. vigilante assertion of the right to attack anywhere in the world because we've got drone technology. Please explain this.
I think when I speak of vigilantism, I'm speaking about when a government or any entity, individual or otherwise, decides that they can violate people's rights, and, you know, particularly to do them harm. But, you know, we have to think about the rights that are violated by the use of drones for the purposes of surveillance and attack. And we've seen, first of all, there's a right to privacy that's considered under the UN Declaration of Human Rights. We've seen in the United States, the government, the military, police use drones to violate people's rights of privacy. And this has happened during Black Lives Matter protests. And another way, national sovereignty. We feel we have a right to national sovereignty, that, you know, other governments don't have attack rights in the United States. There's a right to a fair trial. It's also guaranteed under the Declaration of Human Rights. That's violated when people are summarily killed. There's a right to protection of noncombatants under international law, the principles of war. And it's very clear that drone attacks have indiscriminately harmed and killed noncombatants. There's a right to protection against aggression, certainly aggression based on stealing resources. And the U.S. has used drones as part of their aggression to go into other countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, other places to capture access to oil and other resources. There's a right to protection against weapons that are really guided by artificial intelligence or the use of artificial intelligence for selecting intelligence, for sorting intelligence, which means for targeting. There's also protection against the whole idea a government can, simply because it has the technical capacity to attack, to undertake attacks. And what we have in the situation of Afghanistan, Iraq, and other places where the public is not advantaged in terms of their defense against drones or militarily by comparison to the United States, there's a total incapability to protect themselves against drone war. The United States military talks about their military peers and near peers and not peers. When you're a not peer, it means you have no capability at all to defend yourself against attacks by the other person. And in this case, everywhere the United States has been using drones up to this point for attack are people against people of color and people who are really defenseless against the surveillance and the drone attacks. So that's what I'm talking about with respect to vigilantes.
Nick, in order for military force to be lawful, it must comply with the requirement of distinction, which means that the attack must always distinguish between combatants and civilians. How does the use of killer drones necessarily violate the principle of distinction?
I think that the attack on August 29th in Kabul, Afghanistan, killed 10 civilians, 7 of them children, by the best and the brightest in terms of, you know, drone technicians and technology, really demonstrates everything that we have is not able to discriminate and carry out even the essentially illegal attacks in a way that I guess expected by a very compliant American public. And I think people were really aghast that this thing happened. Of course, it's a typical attack. And what we had in Afghanistan was a situation where the gross mistake was made to do a typical attack under the noses of reporters, especially from the New York Times, who could immediately go to the scene of the attack and interview people and gather evidence. These kind of attacks have been characteristic of what the U.S. has been doing all over, the drone attack zones that they have designated. And basically, President Biden has reserved the right to attack anyone, anytime, any place in the world using this very technology. And this is one reason we want to have a ban against arming drones, because the technology is in no way able to be controlled or discriminating. I want to point out that an organization called JustSecurity.org released on September 13th a list of 92 questions having to do with how did this August 29th attack come about and who was responsible for it. This is something that the Pentagon has just basically blown past by saying nothing illegal was done. I mean, the debate is going to be undertaken about who did what was illegal. There are fundamental questions about what technology was used to identify Mr. Ahmadi as a person to kill. Who was analyzing this technology? How did this surveillance data, how did they come to that conclusion? And who gave the final order to push the button that killed Mr. Ahmadi and these family members? As Marjorie said, it would be very important to know what kind of pressure was coming, if any. It seems like it might very well be pressure was coming from the White House to execute these people based on what might not have otherwise been done. But everything that led to these deaths is characteristic of what has been happening before. And so the bottom line to your question is there is no evidence that this technology can discriminate and should be used either on or off the battlefield, of whatever the battlefield is and whoever describes that, which of course is another legal question.
Nick, drones lead to more civilian deaths than piloted aircrafts. And although George W. Bush used drones, Obama vastly increased their use, and Trump increased it even more. How many were carried out by Obama and by Trump, and now by Biden so far?
Well, thanks to an article that Marjorie wrote that got into the specifics of this. And again, we don't really have exact information about this. But from what people can gather, Trump did or authorized, or his commanders undertook 2,243 drone attacks compared to 1,878 by Obama. But Obama was really the responsible person when it came to vastly expanding drone warfare. Bush, was the first person responsible, but during his term he undertook only 50 attacks. But based on what people saw as successes, quote unquote, which meant basically I saw somebody on the ground, I killed them, wasn't that good that I could do it, rather than who was it and why, and was this even legal for me to do it. But based on the success under Bush, then the number of drone control bases in the U.S. expanded, overseas expanded. Up until right now, we have within the United States and within the lower 48, and if you add Hawaii, now there's more, we have at least 21 drone control centers that undertake killings spread around the United States.
How many civilians were killed by drones during the Obama administration compared to the Trump administration and so far during the Biden administration?
Well, I think that that's a, obviously it's a very good question. It's a very difficult question to answer. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism in the UK has tried to estimate these for various countries. My own opinion is that some 10,000 upward, let's say, I'm hesitating because when we're talking about civilians and military casualties and the way the U.S. has kept track of these, I think it's more appropriate to say that overall the Bureau of Investigative Journalism estimates that up to 10,000 Afghan people have been killed by U.S. drones. Trump did not release as much information about drone attacks as the Biden administration, but it appears to me anyway that at least half of those people and maybe more were killed under Trump, but at the same time, I think it's very hard to tell. I would say, too, that what we are trying to do at Ban Killer Drones is to have the House National Security Subcommittee of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform undertake an investigation of all drone attack victims and their identities since the beginning of the drone wars, which is a monumental task. But the U.S. Congress is the only body that would have even the potential to review all the videotapes, each U.S. drone attack, all the after-action reports of U.S. drone attacks, which will contain not necessarily the identities of all the victims, but it should give us a much better idea of how many people have been killed by these attacks, how many injured, because these attacks are recorded on videotape. And the one place where we would have trouble is some bodies can't be counted because the missiles that are used have basically disintegrated, vaporized, pulverized some of the victims to the point that there would be no way to tell whether there were one, two, three, four people killed. But at least we would have much better information than we have right now. That's a way that we want to go with this. However, you know, we have to say that there are going to be many obstacles put in the way of that investigation, but it is an investigation that can be done if there's enough public pressure for it.
Who was Anwar Awlaki, and what happened to him and later to his son during the Obama administration? What happened when the Center for Constitutional Rights brought a lawsuit on behalf of Anwar's father to remove him from the kill list before he was killed?
Well, the Awlaki case is very distressing, but it's very emblematic of this vigilante interpretation that the United States has. And Awlaki was an American citizen. He was a Yemeni. He was a very eloquent and powerful, through his words, a very powerful person in really bringing forward the challenges that the United States was presenting by its behavior in Yemen and overall. He was really killed because he was exercising free speech, and his free speech was said to be by the United States dangerous. I don't think there's anything in the Constitution that says you can't have dangerous free speech when the government's interpreting danger. And so he was killed by a drone in 2011. His father had attempted to get him off the U.S. kill list through the Center for Constitutional Rights and ended up with the court saying, well, this is a matter that's out of the purview for a number of reasons, one of them being that the drone kill list has been something that political powers that we have no control over have decided have to be undertaken, you know, for national security. And drone attacks, like almost other acts of war or preventing of war, suits to prevent war, really don't get anywhere in U.S. courts. They just say, well, this is up to the government, you know, to decide what needs to be done militarily. So I really equate what happened to him with what happened to Fred Hampton with the Chicago police and FBI. You know, was a very strong, powerful, persuasive leader for Black liberation who was assassinated in his bed by the police and the FBI.
Obama promulgated rules for targeting killing, many of which were revealed in the drone papers, thanks to the whistleblower Daniel Hale, who is now serving 45 months in a federal prison. On Terror Tuesdays, Obama and his high-level officials decided who would be targeted that week. Please explain the Obama requirements for targeted killing and whether these rules were actually followed, and also, are these rules still obtaining today?
I think that these rules do obtain today. I think that targeted people were sorted based on very ambiguous notions of who was a danger and to what degree they were a danger. So people could shift from must kill to maybe kill when we get around to it. There were lawyers like Avril Haines, who now head of National Security Intelligence Agency, Carol Coe, another lawyer for the State Department, whose primary job in relation to drone warfare was to take what was going on, which was essentially illegal, and then provide very narrow and, I guess you'd say, protective legal arguments for things that were just fundamentally immoral and illegal to get it to try to pass muster with the American public. People in other countries know perfectly well what's going on, and the secrecy around these drone attacks, illegal conversations around these drone attacks are really tailored to pacify and to keep ignorant the American public. These lawyers and others have been very busy and pretty successful so far in hoodwinking people about the true nature of what's happening.
How can people follow your work?
They can go to bankillerdrones.org. At that website, you can find a lot of the conversation and discussion that we've been having right now and much more documentation. You can find information about what people are already doing with pictures in different parts of the country. And you can make contact to be involved with activism by writing to our website. More and more people are getting involved in this, and it's very heartening.
Nick, it's been a real, I guess pleasure is the wrong word. It's been very important for us to have you on Law and Disorder. Can you please give your website again before we thank you?
Yes, thank you. It's www.bankillerdrones.org.
Nick, thank you so much for agreeing to speak with us today. I think people will get a lot of very important information that they need to hold our government accountable.
Thank you, Marjorie. Again, I'm very grateful to be able to speak with you all.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.